You're listening to CITR News, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Armand Rana.
And I'm Alex Trabulsi. It's Sunday, the 9th of October at 1.06 p.m. We are recording this episode from our homes, but it's being broadcast from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
City elections are next week. To wrap up our coverage, we speak to Bill Thielman, who is running with Team for a Livable Vancouver.
Bill Thielman has over 20 years of experience as a political consultant, communications roles for various labor and governmental organizations, and a columnist for the Georgia Strait. He also runs his own food, wine, and spirits blog at winebarbarian.ca.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today. So to start us off, could you give us like the elevator pitch for your candidacy for city council?
Absolutely, and thanks for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity. Look, I have never run before for political office, even though, as you mentioned in your wind-up or startup there, I've been involved in politics for a long, long time. I was communications director when Glenn Clark became premier in the re-election win, surprise win in 1996 and everything else. But at the age of 65, I looked around at what's happening in Vancouver, and I was kind of appalled by what was going on. Just way too many problems in our city. And so after talking to several people, I decided I had to put up or shut up. And I had spoken to city council on multiple issues multiple times to no great effect, obviously. And the only person who was paying attention to me, frankly, was Colleen Hardwick, who I'd known for quite a while before she got into politics. So we started having some conversations, and she said to me, look, if you want to change the city, you got to be on city council. You got to have a vote. You got to have a voice at all decision making. And so I said, okay. And, you know, I set up my nomination meeting. I'm 65 years old. I'm kind of crazy to be doing this, but I'm still younger than Joe Biden and Gene Swanson.
Yeah, so, for sure.
With we'll get to specifically joining Team in a second, but on the Team website, it states that, quote, we chose the name Team because we were inspired by the insights and legacies of the Electors Action Movement, the party that brought the residents together in 1968 to save Strathcona, Chinatown, Gastown, and Vancouver's waterfront from a freeway system, end quote. For our listeners, could you expand on what the original team was about and how that legacy informs you today?
Yeah, that's a great question, because really, I'm old enough to remember Team, although I wasn't of voting age at that time. But I know what we had. Art Phillips, who was one of Vancouver's best mayors ever, went on later to become a federal Liberal MP, but also Mike Harcourt, who became NDP premier and mayor himself later, Darlene Marzari, who was an NDP cabinet minister, and others who were connected to the federal Liberals and provincial NDP. So it was a real coalition party. And it came together because Vancouver was at great peril. The Chinatown Freeway project was going ahead. We had a very developer, not just friendly, developer slavishly devoted council. And so the city's entire future was at risk there. And I feel the same way. I've said before, the battle for the soul of Vancouver is going on right now, and big developers are winning. And we see more of that between the two current parties, Kennedy Stewart and his Forward Together, taking massive amounts of donations from major corporate developers, using Francesco Aquilini, also the owner of the Canucks, but a big developer, as a captain for fundraising. And the leaked document that came out a few weeks ago showed that Mr. Aquilini had raised about $65,000 for Kennedy Stewart and Forward Together. You also saw that the Walls, the Ducatuses, the Boses, like just about every major developer you can name, it was on that list. But they're also on Ken Sim and ABC's list as donors as well, making the maximum donations, some of the family members and probably executives. And here at Team, like, again, this is, you know, the city is at peril, and Team is refusing to take any major corporate developer donations. We've actually rejected some that were refunded or returned them when they were made, because we don't think it's right. The biggest single factor and job of a city council is to deal with development issues and give permits and do rezonings. And so it's just wrong, even if it's only a perceived conflict of interest, that a developer would show up at city council with a $100 million project on the books, needing council to approve changes. And as that developer and that corporation looks across the council chambers, they see that a majority of those people sitting there were the beneficiary of their donations. So even if that doesn't influence the vote of council members, a perception of conflict is often as bad as an actual conflict. And so we're not going to put ourselves in that position. Pretty clearly that the current council has put themselves in that position. There's three ABC councillors, Kennedy Stewart as the mayor, and they are not just taking, but they are out actively soliciting as much money as they can from the development community. And that's just wrong in our view.
Right. Okay. Well, clearly passionate about that. So with your career prior to running for city council, you were primarily working with, I think fair to say, sort of left-leaning organizations like the provincial NDP and the BC Federation of Labor. Moving over to team, at least from the outside looking in for me, it's pretty ostensibly fiscally conservative party. And I'm wondering what motivated you to choose this party to run for city council?
Well, I think two things, Alex and Arnon. The first of all, team is a coalition. We've got Cleta Brown running for city council. She's the daughter of the legendary Rosemary Brown, the first Black woman elected to any legislature in Canada, who also ran for the leadership of the federal NDP. And Cleta ran for the Greens in a previous election. I'm obviously NDP and labor oriented, although I have lots of business clients as well in my practice as a consultant. We've got Stephen Roberts, who ran for the BC Liberals in the past. We've got Sean Nardi, who's a community activist and fought at the Denny's site on West Broadway and also the Broadway and Granville project. We've got Grace Kwan, who is a high-tech entrepreneur and has been also worked for the Federal Treasury Board prior to getting into clean tech. And we've got Param Nijjar, who is a small-scale builder and realtor who does a lot of laneway housing and small projects. And so we've got a really good skill base there. And I think I was attracted by the quality, and Colleen has been in the film and TV industry where I first met her, and also in tech doing startups as an entrepreneur. So it's a very talented group, and I was pleased to join with them. But the other thing is, at the municipal level, it's not so left-right as provincial and federal politics. The issues are really around development, housing, permitting, and obviously keeping the streets clean, policing, fire, public safety. And on all those issues, I think that we stand at team very much in the center, if not center left, of politics, if you insist on a left-right dichotomy. But I think our positions are most important around the issues of development, and we want to see more affordable housing. For example, we proposed a $500 million co-op program, which would create homes for over 4,000 people on city lands, up to 2,000 units. And we could triple that if the federal and provincial government were to come in and match that, as they should. No other party has proposed that, and certainly no other party running for the mayoralty. All the other parties are saying we want more supply, more development, high-rise concrete towers like the Broadway plan, which projects 500 blocks from 16th to 1st and from Clark Drive in the east to Vine Street in Kitsilano. Three towers per block, concrete high rises up to 40 stories around subway stations and 20 and 30 nearby and minimum of 12 in other areas. One city, for example, which also voted for the Broadway plan, has proposed 6 stories anywhere in any block in the entire city. And we don't agree with that. We want to see affordable housing, but the Broadway corridor sector, those 500 blocks, is home to about 25% of the affordable low-rise housing in all of Vancouver. And those people will be rent evicted and demo evicted. And this so-called renters protection plan that Kennedy Stewart dreamed up, the idea that you could take people out of their apartments that are going to be demolished to be replaced with 20 and 40 story towers, put them somewhere else in the city temporarily for a few years, like 2, 3, 4 years, in a 1% vacancy market, and then move them back in for the same rent or less, is an absolute fantasy land. There's no way. Not a single private developer has said, we can do that. And in fact, others have said, absolutely can't do that. And I fear that if team doesn't win this election, that after the election, the developers will come back to council and say, you know what, this isn't working. The renter protection plan doesn't work. And we need more stratas. We can't do all market rentals. We need stratas. And we're not going to move anybody. We'll give them a little payout to go away. So for me, the Broadway plan was the clincher to run for city council, because it is such a bad plan.
And obviously, Broadway plan and development being a pretty core issue for bringing team together under a coalition. Are there any other issues that have sort of like bolstered up this tent?
Well, I think the public safety issue is a huge problem. I live in Kitsilano, very close to 10th and Waterloo, where a young woman about 2 months ago was attacked at night by two guys who punched her in the face 7 times, stole her purse, stole her cell phone. And, you know, we think of Kitsilano as a fairly safe neighborhood. So people in our neighborhood were pretty shocked by that. Obviously, the downtown east side is just in disastrous shape. The tent city, the parks, we saw the stabbings at Crab Park these last couple of days. There's all sorts of problems going on, but you can't solve things, as Ken Sim and ABC have suggested. Well, Ken Sim actually said out loud and runs ads about it, I'll hire 100 police on the first day in office and 100 mental health nurses. First of all, the city doesn't hire the police. The police board does, and the majority of appointees are not made by the city. They're made by the province. Secondly, the health ministry hires nurses, not the city. And if you want to start branching out into areas that are completely outside your jurisdiction, it's a very, very slippery slope. But secondly, you can't find 100 police officers, and you definitely can't find 100 mental health nurses. There's almost 4,000 vacancies for nurses in the entire province right now. How on earth could you find people to go in and deal with the experience to deal with the most stressful situations, drug and mental health crises or combinations thereof, where the person could turn violent, and so you want police and a mental health nurse? You can't find 100 of each of those. It'll take years and years and years to do that. What we said, let's get us back to police officer staffing to the level we had in 2010 proportionate to our population. And that would require probably about 60 new officers to be hired. And it would take a couple of years to find them for sure. So these glib promises by somebody who Ken Sim's never shown up at city council once to speak to any issue, including the policing budget cut of $5.7 million that Kennedy Stewart and a majority made year before last. Ken Sim was nowhere to be found. He hasn't spoken to council one time in 4 years, and yet he wants to be the mayor. He wants to start the job at the top.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So I think Alex will have some follow-ups about policing in a bit, but I want to come back to the Broadway plan. So as you mentioned, the team is opposed to the Broadway plan, and it's kind of one of the big, galvanizing motivators for team. And the framing that the opposition that you gave is largely around protecting existing renters. However, there is an aspect, you know, similarly to how you said, you know, it's problematic for, you know, some of the wealthiest corporate developers to be supporting the parties that are, you know, supporting more development options. In the same way, there are some of the most wealthiest and privileged people in Vancouver who have homes in the, you know, Point Grey region or the Kitsilano region, who don't want them, or, you know, in Colchena or something like that, who don't want the, you know, their views obscured by larger towers, who maybe don't want, you know, property tax increases, and who are also, you know, probably supporting team. Does this concern you at all?
Well, I think we say Team for a Livable Vancouver, that's our party name, and we say A Voice for All Neighborhoods. The problem we have with the Broadway plan, for example, is there wasn't a single public hearing, not one, until the council meeting, which is not really a public hearing, it's a decision-making hearing, but a public hearing where people could ask questions, council members and the mayor could hear the concerns of communities, and staff and council could provide answers. That didn't happen once on the biggest single project Vancouver's ever undertaken, and that's shameful. And, you know, yes, we had COVID, but there was still ample opportunity for more dialogue and more consultation. We threw out every single neighborhood plan that had been developed over the past 20, 25 years with countless hours of volunteers and staff time. So, I mean, there's a Kitsilano plan, there's a Fairview plan, there's just about plan for every neighborhood in the city, and they're all thrown out the window for the Broadway plan and then the subsequent Vancouver plan. So we haven't had that consultation. Clearly, towers work in certain parts of the city, and clearly the West End is full of high-rise towers, and lots of people live there, and they like it, and that's fine. That's totally fine. But, you know, we have to have some measure of citizen input and control to give some semblance of democracy and having the right to say what goes on in your neighborhood. I don't think the idea that you could suddenly plunk a 6 or 12-story building in a single-family housing block is a good idea. But if the people there said, hey, we like it, it's good in that neighborhood, but I don't think it makes sense. And people have, obviously, whether they're renters or owners, they have their neighborhood, they like it, they live there. certainly for owners, they've invested the biggest single investment in their lives is in their house or apartment. And I don't think the city should just say, well, you know, that's nice, but, and you bought it knowing what the zoning was, but we're turning it on its head and we're doing it right away. And going even further, one city suggested that it just be up to staff. There'd be not even a public hearing at city council for rezoning if it was within certain parameters of up to six stories on any block in the entire city. So that to me is the epitome of destroying local democracy and destroying citizens' right to have their say on what goes on in their city and their neighborhood.
So, yeah, just to follow up on that. So, you know, the existing member of team who's currently on council, Colleen Hardwick, has mm-hmm. practically voted against nearly, you know, every major rezoning, if that would be a fair characterization, over the last, you know, few years. At the same time, do you perceive that there is any sort of housing shortage in Vancouver, or you don't perceive there to be a housing shortage at all?
There's clearly a housing shortage. There's an affordable housing shortage, and that's one of the problems that we have here. We have people like Bob Rennie, the condo marketer. We have major developers saying supply, 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 supply. Well, we've had 4 years of that, and we have the highest rents and the lowest vacancy and the highest housing prices. So clearly what we're doing isn't working. First of all. Second, there have been 256 rezoning applications over the last 4 years. You're talking about ones that Councillor Colleen Hardwick, our mayoral candidate, voted against. The number that were rejected is zero. Zero for 256. So pretty clearly she did not stop any developments whatsoever. But she did vote in favor of social housing developments and other ones where she felt that it was useful. But for these major, major projects, which clearly... they're driving the price of land and the price of housing, whether it be rental or ownership, driving it up. Every time you rezone, you spot rezone in one area, the surrounding area, the prices go up. And we've seen that over and over. This council has become addicted to community amenity contribution grants from major developers and development permits. And so we go further and further down the road. And what we see from, you know, the other parties is let's build higher, let's build bigger, let's build more. And yet, that's what we've been doing. Lastly, there's 100,000 homes in the pipeline right now that have not been, not yet been built or are not completed. The number of housing projects that have actually been completed during this last 4 years is 1% of what was passed, just 1%. And we've also said the city permitting process is way too slow, way too expensive. It adds up to, in most cases, about a quarter of the cost of a housing unit, whether it be an apartment or a house. A quarter. So that is one of the biggest impediments and one of the reasons why Vancouver is the most high priced city in North America.
But wouldn't, you know, if you're a, you know, some, you know, person in their 20s living in a basement somewhere and you're hearing what you describe as having, you know, the slow permitting process, sure. But then what you're also describing is having even more consultation with people who are living in single family homes and getting their input on whether we should build add more social housing supply. If I'm somebody living in a basement somewhere, kind of with a family of two or three people, kind of feeling stressed out about the rent I'm already paying, it seems like my issues may not be like really being centered or prioritized if there's so much consultation that needs to take place prior to you know, more supply being added.
Well, I mean, a couple of things on that one. I think we can say pretty safely that if a neighborhood and a community are just fine with a development, there's no reason for it to take forever and go through a massive public hearing process. But in the Broadway plan and the Arbutus housing, BC housing project, there were hundreds of people who signed up to speak, and they were almost all, I mean, overwhelmingly objecting to it. And that's the kind of thing we're talking about. There's all sorts of projects that have flown through city council with no debate at all, because no one objected, that we weren't hearing from the community. But I don't think that the community has been properly consulted on the Broadway plan alone. I talk to people every day who have not even heard about the Broadway plan. They don't know that there's going to be a 40-story tower going up at Broadway and Granville. It's under construction right now, that there's going to be a whole bunch of them all around the subway stations for the SkyTrain extension. So I don't think that's the case. Secondly, if we allow the demo eviction in the Broadway plan corridor, those 500 blocks of 25% of affordable rentals that are low rise, it is only going to exacerbate people who are living in those places. You take 25% of the market and say, hey, it's gone for years. And when you come back, it'll be smaller and more expensive. And you'll be living in a concrete tower. That's not going to help anybody who's living in a basement suite looking for other housing now. That's why we proposed the co-op housing fund using city lands, $500 million, as I mentioned before, so that we can create up to housing for up to 4,000 or more people and hopefully get the federal and provincial government to make it 12,000, because we have to do something different. The affordable housing crisis has been, you know, I've lived in Vancouver most of my life. It's been constantly a problem. And I've been renovicted before, both here and in Toronto. I've lived that situation, and it's terrible. But demolishing a quarter of the existing affordable housing stock for renters is the absolute worst way to create more housing. The idea that big developers
just to jump
are...
In here,
go ahead.
Is that a fair characterization? Because especially at the position you're mentioning around one city, it seems the emphasis is largely around rezoning actually single family neighborhoods and, allowing, six story condos there. It's not necessarily about you're opposed to that as well, right? And
yeah,
so when you're talking about single family neighborhoods, it's not existing rental towers. It's largely a lot of homeowners that would be opposed to that plan. When you're talking about the community engagement, that local community is a group of homeowners who are opposed to that plan, right?
Well, I mean, I guess we'll find out in the election, but the 500 blocks in the Broadway plan include lots of, there's areas like mine. I live right on Broadway, and there's no single family homes on Broadway, but the block behind me on 10th and 11th and 12th, those are mostly single family homes, and it goes up to 16th and down to 1st. So there's a huge swath of a variety of zoning levels, but all of which would be subject to 12 story to 40 story for that enormous area. So,
but you also stated you were opposed to 6 story. That's what I'm saying. You said you were opposed
to six story
and single family homes.
What I said was, Armand, I said that we believe the neighbor should have a say,
yeah,
and we don't believe that staff should be able to decide. You have one bylaw passed, and after that, staff decides without any public hearings, without any consultation. You wake up one day and you find a 6-story building is going up next to your house and it's the only one on the block. That's not the way to do proper planning. Vancouver was renowned for its extremely careful and sensitive and useful Vancouver city planning. It's known as Vancouverism. And we're throwing that out the window. We're throwing all our community plans out the window and just saying to major developers, go ahead, do whatever you want. And no consultation with the community. And that's, I would never agree to that. And I also know it won't help renters. It won't help homeowners who are looking for a first place. Those are not the ways to do it, because we've seen it over and over. Like, we've had that basically for 4 years. If we've had 256 applications for rezoning and everyone passed, it's not exactly like we're stopping rezoning. It's like full speed ahead. And yet look at the results, like the lowest vacancy, the highest rent, the highest housing prices for homeownership as well.
Okay, and moving on to another topic. So on the team's website, it states that we should, quote, be realistic about Vancouver's contribution to climate change and ensure mitigation measures are effective without overburdening already financially stressed residents, end quote. What specific climate change mitigation efforts would you scrap that are overburdening residents?
Oh, well, we'd have to go through a long list. And I think what we need to do is if we have a team majority or a team majority support on a council, we would have to look at everything. But, we've got things. Taxes have gone up in the last 4 years, 25%, way, way above inflation. And that's because council has a lot of priorities that are outside of the regular jurisdiction of a city, whether it's Vancouver or any other city. So it keeps impinging on federal and provincial. And certainly climate change initiatives are federal and provincial primarily. Yes, the city can do things, but if taxpayers want to, first of all, expand the level of priorities and core services for Vancouver City, I guess they've got to vote for the Green Party in one city who are particularly keen on this. But there's all sorts of things that we're doing that are duplication or are not required. We just saw city council vote to spend $700,000 on a lawsuit against big oil and gas, which could take decades. And the first argument the oil companies would make is does the city of Vancouver use gasoline or diesel in any of its vehicles? Do its citizens drive gas and diesel vehicles? Because how can you be suing somebody for air pollution and climate change when all of your voters and citizens and residents and taxpayers use the same product? It just doesn't make any sense. So there's a lot of things there that are being done that are really not productive for a city. At the same time, policing is down. Our roads are crumbling. Our sidewalks are crumbling. I'm a motorcyclist. There's places in the city that I think someone could have a fatal accident on just because the roads are in such bad shape. So we're not doing the basics, and yet we're doing extended, expensive, and unproductive climate change projects that are not going to make any significant difference in short or even probably medium to long term.
And we're just going to transition again, jump back to another topic over to policing, which I think we had briefly mentioned before. So you brought up Ken Sims' promise to hire 100 new police staff. Obviously, police in Vancouver is the largest line item on the city budget. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on the adequacy of policing in Vancouver.
Well, it's clearly inadequate. When you have 4 stranger attacks a day, random stranger attacks, including the one I mentioned earlier in the show, there's obviously something wrong. But we've got break-ins at businesses all over the city. I live in Kitsilano. I mentioned our local Shoppers Drug Mart, the plate glass window smashed in so someone could steal some perfume and things out of the window. Thousands of dollars of damage. Most of the small businesses or large businesses, their insurance deductibles either are too high to recoup that, so the business pays for it, or they're going to see their premiums go up because it's so rampant that it keeps happening. And my friend John Claridis, who owns Marquee Wines, his plate glass window smashed in, his electric bike stolen for deliveries, $6,000 to $10,000 damage. It's all on film. No one's been caught. Nothing's happened. So we see all sorts of other problems. People being stabbed, all over the city, there's been these kind of assaults. And what we haven't done is keep pace with the population growth in Vancouver. So the last time policing and population synced up was 2010. And since then, it's gone down and down and down, to the extent that city council at the end of 2021 voted to cut the police, or sorry, 2020, voted to cut the police budget by $5.7 million, sort of a defund the police thing. And only because the province overruled that and said, no, you can't do that, there's too much need for policing in Vancouver, was that money restored. So, no one's going to say you can police your way out of a problem. We have an opioid overdose problem. We have a crime problem. We have a mental health and addictions problem. And they all have to be addressed. But the city can't address all of them all at once. And you cannot have a situation where the public feels that they are unsafe in the city. That causes multiple ramifications on our economy, on public morale, on everything the city does. And so we have to have more police. We have to have police on the beat. This is another thing. We have walking the streets, keeping public order, particularly in parts of the city where we've got bigger problems. We need to have more police on the beat. And that's something else we've called for at Team.
Right. It's kind of cliche to bring up the Downtown East Side when we talk about policing, but I think this specific aspect is related, is that one of your party's items is for a quote-unquote full-time Downtown East Side commissioner with a mandate to address the out-of-control social issues that are impacting the health and safety of the community and ensuring that needed resources are provided and properly distributed to those who need them. Could you provide some details on what this position actually entails?
Sure. What we've proposed is to have somebody go in, a commissioner go in, and start auditing all of different expenditures going on at the federal, provincial, and Vancouver City level. Because we know hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars are being spent on the Downtown East Side. And yet, if you were to go down there today, compare it to 4 years ago or 8 years ago, it's dramatically worse. It's clearly deteriorating rapidly. People are being victimized by criminals and drug dealers. There are people there who are poor. That doesn't mean that they have mental health or addiction problems, and they're being victimized as well. And yet we're spending so much money, and the situation gets worse and worse. So clearly, you know, if you're in a deep hole, stop digging. I mean, but so much of the council seems to think just spend more and go to safe supply and go to something else and go to something else. It's not working, and we need to take a very hard look, figure out how much is being spent, how effective it is, and then look at how we can do better. We've seen countries like Portugal who have managed to get a handle on mental health and addiction issues successfully. There's other jurisdictions. Portland has dealt with homelessness quite a bit in a much more successful way than Vancouver has. And yet we just throw money at it and do the same thing and expect the situation to change, which is, of course, the definition of insanity. We got to find some way to get a handle on this. And one of the ways is to have somebody take an overarching view and look at all the programs, look at what the federal government's doing, look what the provincial government's doing, look what the city's doing, and come up with ways that we can do a better job.
Right. A few things to touch on is the idea then to have the commissioner be sort of, a city version of an auditor, even a royal commission?
Not a royal commission, no, but certainly they would do an audit of all of the expenditures going on, make sure that we understand what the expenditure is, what its usefulness is, how effective has it been. There's all sorts of things that we do, and it may sound good on the surface, but may not be doing anything substantive to improve the situation. We know housing is a big problem, but we also know the provincial government has been buying up SROs. We've got Portland Hotel Society, Atira, and others who are running some of the worst slum landlord hotels from the past. How successful they've been? Why do we have all these fires in the downtown east side? There's so many questions that we don't have answers for, and we need somebody to pull all the strings together and figure that out, and then say, okay, here's a better way forward based on experiences in other jurisdictions.
Right, and as you previously mentioned, I believe Portland and Portugal with their approach to mental health and addictions, obviously. The United States cities have a bit more leeway to operate in that sense, and Portugal is, well, a country. How would Vancouver, say, theoretically, Vancouver came to the conclusion that a similar decriminalization or harm reduction program was necessary? How would Vancouver going about actually getting or bringing that into service in the city?
Well, I mean, quite clearly, the city is limited by the legislation called the Vancouver Charter. It's provincial legislation. So there's only certain things that we can do, and other things would have to be done by the federal government or by the provincial government. So we have to look at who's got which jurisdiction and what is it we want to do. I hope that the province and the federal government want to try and find a way to fix these problems. And I think we have to be the catalyst and the impetus for it to do so. But we can't do it alone for sure as a city, but we can find a way forward. We can try and find a path forward that will improve things. Because, I mean, basically, when everything you're doing makes things worse, you got to stop. You got to look at it and figure out a better way, because it's not going to improve by doing more of the same.
So switching gears again to transportation, what are your thoughts on the SkyTrain to UBC? I believe TEAM is currently suggesting putting that project on hold. Why is that?
Well, we think it's a massive expenditure, $7 billion for a fairly short line, because it's, you know, somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion a kilometer for underground. We could instead put we could have a 58 kilometer LRT system all around, including UBC, all around the city, including South Vancouver and other areas. And look at, SkyTrain technology is used almost nowhere in the world. I mean, it is a rare bird indeed, whereas LRTs are in hundreds, if not thousands, of cities around the world. And it's not that you only have LRT. We have a SkyTrain system. Obviously, the extension to Arbutus is going forward. But beyond that, why would we continue to use the most expensive and rare form of technology instead of looking at what other cities are doing? I mean, we know I mentioned Portland again for LRT, but if you look at San Francisco, look at Boston, look at Amsterdam, look at London, look at Paris. There's LRT systems that are moving, you know, tens of thousands of people successfully in cities that are much, much bigger than Vancouver. And so if you say you either get 7 kilometers or 58 kilometers of transit, I think it makes much more sense to look at the LRT system and and find a way that we can actually not just do one short spur line, which is really, you know, in many ways, it's a development play more than it is transit planning. And I've said that before. We see that around SkyTrain stations, there's enormous development, and that's something that, you know, major corporate developers are very, very keen on. But LRT, it distributes and is better for local business. It's better for getting more people around to more places. And I think it just makes much more sense to do that. And that's what we proposed.
Yeah, there's a lot that you said there. So you mentioned that it's good for local business. Could you just expand on that a bit more? And also, what would you say to people? There was a report that came out that said that, you know, that if you took an LRT to UBC, it'll be over capacity around 2040 or 2045, and there wouldn't really be an option to increase the capacity then without moving to some sort of SkyTrain system.
Well, I mean, we're looking at, as I said, 58 kilometers of light rail versus 7 kilometers of SkyTrain. So in terms of what you could include, I mean, we could have, and we've identified some 4 priority corridors, UBC to the P&E via Granville Island and New St. Paul Hospital, that's 17 kilometers. Arbutus Marine Line from Crosstown to Marine Station and River District, that's 15 kilometers. 41st, UBC to Metrotown, 18 kilometers. Commercial Victoria Line, another 8 kilometers. So we could have so much more. So it's not simply saying everyone's going to go from Arbutus Station to UBC down Broadway and up whichever route you would choose. You'd have multiple options depending on where you live. And so if you live in South Vancouver, you wouldn't necessarily have to go anywhere near Broadway and Arbutus at all. You would be on an LRT that was close to where you live. So it distributes population, and it creates more local business opportunities around those lines. Whereas SkyTrain, if you're not a big business, the odds of you having any possible retail business near a SkyTrain line is just about zero, because it's so expensive. The rents around there are phenomenal, and it really concentrates. It kind of exports jobs to the subway stations as opposed to distributing them throughout the city. So I think it makes much more sense. And I'll admit, I thought originally SkyTrain to UBC made a lot of sense, but as I've looked at it more and more, the costs and the alternatives, it only makes sense to me that this is the way it should be done.
So continuing with this theme, so Vancouver has an at-large voting system for city councillors. This means that 10 councillors represent the whole of Vancouver. Charlie Smith, the editor of Georgia Strait, has often argued that this system discriminates against minorities and those with non-European surnames. I know you have a history of, you know, being, you know, in favor of a first-past-the-post system, provincially and otherwise. So what are your thoughts on this system and in terms of moving to a ward system?
I'm in favor of the ward system. I campaigned and endorsed it when we've had referendums in the past. What team has proposed is that we will definitely look at some kind of alternative system that would include a geographic constituency component to it. So wards would be the most obvious one. There's also possibilities of a hybrid system where you'd have perhaps 5 or 6 councils elected by region, by community, and 5 or 6 elected at large along with the mayor. I personally prefer a ward system where you would have geographic ridings, so that people could say, if you live in Kitsilano, so-and-so is your council person. If you live in Fairview, this person is your representative. If you live in South Vancouver, this is your representative. And so then you know who's responsible, and you can hold them accountable for what they do. Right now, you have 10 councillors elected at large, and nobody's actually responsible for any particular neighborhood or area of the whole city, nor is the mayor. So that just doesn't work for me. I think that's the wrong kind of democracy. And that doesn't have anything to do with proportional representation at all. I'm in favor of a ward system or some other form of geographic representation, so people know exactly who's responsible and can hold them accountable. So that's one thing. The other thing is, this system, at large system, plays to big money. And even though the province you know, banned corporate and union donations, we still see developers finding a way around that by raising money for parties that support massive developments and concrete towers. And so, you know, that's clearly not working. But if you, me as a candidate, if you run as an independent, it's even worse, because you'd have to try and get your message across to, you know, 450, 500,000 voters on a very limited budget. Even what's happening now, again, we see that Ken Sim and ABC have raised $1.6 million to spend on this election, and they're running radio, TV, bus shelter ads, social media ads. I mean, it's a tsunami of ads, and they're raising money from some of the wealthiest individuals and the developer corporate developers who want to see that kind of a program going. So it makes it extremely difficult. At least with a ward system or a geographic representation system, it would be much more possible for people to run as independents or for parties to run candidates with a reasonable chance that it's a level playing field.
And really quick to jump in on changing the voting system in the city from at large to some type of ward or ward adjacent system. Is there any desire as well to change the amount of councilors should a new system come in, or is 10 kind of the, I guess, magic number?
I don't think there's anything that's absolutely hard and fast. I think we now have 9 provincial representatives in our legislature, and that will presumably expand to 10 under the Boundaries Commission recommendations for another seat in Vancouver. So that's one possible way. We have federal ridings as well. I think, you know, we should have a solid look at it. I think it, you know, it should make sense for the city that neighborhood boundaries are really represent, you know, one or two neighborhoods and not split them up as sometimes the provincial and federal ridings sometimes are bizarre. Like Vancouver Quadra is a bizarre across the city kind of riding that doesn't make much sense from Point Grey into South Vancouver and into East Vancouver. That doesn't really make much sense to me. So I think that's for, again, a community consultation. Let's see what people want to do and then act on it if we get the opportunity.
All right. Well, thank you for your time today, Bill. Is there anything else about Team Vancouver you'd like to highlight before we drop off?
Well, I think, again, there's been just one thing. Some commentators have said, well, we're splitting the right wing vote. I wouldn't run for a right wing party. Like, I'm a lifelong NDP member. I work with the labor movement. I'm left to center. There's no way I would run for a right wing party. And so I'd reject that notion completely. And we're the only party proposing massive co-op development, $500 million co-op development. We're the only party saying that's running for mayor saying we're not going to take corporate developer donations at all. The two other leading parties, Kennedy Stewart and Ford Together and Ken Sim at ABC, are courting major corporate developers. They're asking for their money, and they have a program which those developers would benefit from. I think it's pretty clear there. So to be labeled as right or center right to me is completely wrong. And again, also looking at our candidates, myself, Cleta Brown, others who do not have a right-wing background, we've got people with from right, left, center, green, you name it, involved in this. And that's because it's a true coalition, but it is not right of center.
Yeah, thanks so much again, Bill. So that brings us to the end of today's show. To close, you can find us on CIT News on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. So check us out there.
This episode was edited by myself, Akhil Krishnan, and my co-host, Arman Raina. The music in this piece is by Sarah Pratt. You can find her on SoundCloud at the handle Leisure Noise. The link is in the description. Please subscribe to our podcast for future episodes, and thank you for listening.